And now, for our more dreadful sacrifice.
Boy, all we gotta do is build an act, make you star. Dumbo the Great!
Zero G, and I feel fine.
Slime-eating dogs, you scum-sucking pigs, you sons of a motherless goat.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Howdy, you are listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, and you're now listening to Bums on Seats, the sort of movie review show your mother warned you about. My name is Toby Miller, and with me in the studio today are Ozzy Osman.
Hello.
Jack Toy.
Howdy.
And Mark Livisich.
Yeehaw.
Today's films are here to lose us in warm, welcoming worlds of science fiction, fantasy, friendship and religion. We've reviews of the alien encounters of Arrival, the hardships of the innocents, the motivational feline of a street cat named Bob, and we'll cap the show with a return to the wonderful wizarding world of J.K. Rowling with Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Plus, we preview a short season of modern Russian cinema coming to Cambridge courtesy of the Cambridge Russian Speaking Society. So lots to come, but first, we're minding our language.
There are days that define your story beyond your life. Like the day they arrived.
Signs of what might be called first contact. The objects measure at least...
I'm Colonel G.T. Weber from Army Intelligence.
Pack your bags.
You're at the top of everyone's list when it comes to translations.
Priority one. What do they want? Where are they from? You'll be reporting to me, but you'll be working with him when you're in the show.
That's what they're calling the UFO.
It's tough.
Yeah, that just happened.
What happens now?
They arrive.
They need to see me.
Dr. Banks?
Are you insane?
That's a proper introduction.
When it comes to first contact with extraterrestrial life, Hollywood films usually like to shoot first and ask questions later. But this trigger-happy attitude takes a backseat with new release, Arrival. Based on the novella Story of Your Life and directed by Denis Villeneuve, Arrival opens with the appearance of 12 alien craft, inscrutable ovals of black that hang threateningly silent over various points around the globe. With the ships showing no sign of their intent, the American military call in linguistic professor Dr. Louise Banks, played by Amy Adams, to help start a conversation. Together with a physicist played by Jeremy Renner, Banks enters one of the gravity-defying ships armed with nothing but a whiteboard and an expert knowledge of our alphabet. Mark, the mix of science fiction and emotion in Arrival has won many, many compliments. Were you as impressed by the film's big brain, but its equally big heart?
I was. I'm a fan of science fiction for both its heart and its brain at its best, and I think Arrival shows both at its best. And I think it gets the balance of those two very well indeed. It's showing a science fiction perspective from the perspective of a single individual, in this case Amy Adams' Dr. Louise Banks, so we don't even see the alien spacecraft until she sees them, so we're very much viewing things through her eyes, and the film does lots of things to play with that perspective and play with that perception. But it's also a film, I think, that rewards you if you're paying attention, because it gives back a lot in terms of the themes. It does feel deeply timely, particularly because of the themes about communication in the era in which we're living, where we're hearing fake news, where the word of the year is post-truth. To see a film which is so keen to understand the nature of communication couldn't feel more timely. But there's a pulsing, beating human heart as well, and I just loved it.
To be fair, every film feels timely now. every single film on the programme today, as disparate as the themes are, all of them are timely.
Yes, I mean, it may be the way we're feeling we don't get much more time to watch them before the end of the world, but that's just my liberal politics show. So
it's true. You'll see, the novella it's taken from is non-linear in its approach. It breaks up the text, it breaks up the narrative. That's not a technique that can translate very well to film. It's a difficult technique to translate to film. Certainly a mainstream, and this is still a mainstream film. Does it manage that balancing act? Because it's vital that we don't quite know where we are in the time stream.
To some extent, it does. However, a lot of the issues I have with Arrival actually do concern the narrative and more actually how it's executed. So Arrival for me was a very interesting experience. I went with a bunch of people, half of whom loved it, absolutely loved it, half of whom hated it. And one of the guys I was with, he said, and I'm quoting here, "This is one of the stupidest films I've ever, ever seen." And I think what his reserves came down to were perhaps the execution of the writing, of the script, and of the narrative. I think in places, it was almost like I just couldn't take certain things seriously because I felt like the script was so shoddily written, especially concerning certain key moments in the narrative. For example, there's a point where, without giving too much away,
we can be a bit spoilerific. The film's been out for a week. We'll have a little bit more difficulty with Fantastic Beasts later, but I think we can not edge around quite so much.
Okay, well, there's a certain key scene where something is revealed and a character talks about his wife's dying words, and it's sort of a crux of a certain point in the narrative, and you know, it's building up to this, and people where I was in the cinema were just laughing at it. And I don't know, there were certain elements of just how it was put together and how it was quite cliche that just didn't quite wash with me. Having said that, I actually did like it for the most part. I think it's analysis of communication. I am a linguist, so talking about language, talking about how we communicate, which is the crux of the whole film, in my opinion, I do think that was explored quite well. So I'm a bit 50-50.
Let's bring Jack in on this point and then come back to you, Mark. But Jack, it is a film that unusually, I mean, Interstellar tries, but then that's a film that also tries to convince us that love is science. It's a film which is that sets out to be intellectual, and it's nice to see scientists just as scientists. But does it try? Does it eventually adopt too much of a conventional dramatic shape as it goes on, as it starts to have a story, or at least senses it has to have a story?
Here's my analogy. It's Microsoft Paint, and you start off with a very fine paintbrush, and this is how the film is presented. And then halfway through your painting on Microsoft Paint, you get a bit sleepy and you kind of lean on the mouse, and all of a sudden the paintbrush goes from a fine nib to a huge, huge sloshy bucket, and they're just painting the colour, let's say red, for romance and family, and it gets too obvious for me. I'm trying to think of some positives about it. I liked the set design of the...
Did you really not... I mean, I have issues with it, but I really... I mean, I found a lot to like. Did you really not like this film at all?
We have
Perhaps I should have just started with, do you like this film?
We have a little kind of test when we go to see films at the cinema, and it's... If you're looking over at your partner or the person that you've gone to the film with more than five times in the film with that kind of knowing glance where you raise your eyebrows, something's up with the film. John and I were looking at each other about 15 times in the film over key points, and it's like the clunk test, and it was too obvious a shift from like sci-fi to family drama to timey-wimey Doctor Who splits a narrative over and over again. And then whoever wrote the dialogue, "Let's make babies." Oh God, let's whisper it a bit quieter and it will make it a bit more naff. The soundtrack as well.
I don't remember that, but
it's as the camera panned around in full circle around the couple. You mentioned Interstellar. I really, really like Interstellar. A great thing about Interstellar was the soundtrack, the Hans Zimmer score. This one, it's literally like they've ripped off 1980s Doctor Who, the Five Doctors, where they all get stranded on a planet. It's that...
Oh, that's my favourite. I think that's unfair, because they're unlikely to have seen that, to be fair.
I also think there's an awful lot to like about Johan Johansson's soundtrack. I mean, he's a regular composer with Denis Villeneuve, and I think he's done some fantastic work here. So,
does this break your heart a little bit, Mark, to hear? So, I wasn't expecting quite this much negativity.
It doesn't, because the joy of film is that people will take...
Or do you have the self-belief to believe in your own own opinion, like me.
No, I had the self-belief. I'm disappointed that people didn't find as much from it as I did, but, you know, people find a lot from Nine Lives or Dirty Grandpa, and I appreciate that films are for different people. I suppose I'm keen to understand why people didn't like it as much as I did, to make sure that I'm actually not overly judging it. Because, you know, I have a firm belief in the quality of this film, and actually I think where Jack has seen things which were too big and too bold for him, I actually appreciate that brashness, that boldness. You know, it's a film that very much wears its heart on its sleeve.
But doesn't that, I mean, the problem I had with it, and why I started, I don't have Jack's idea of looking to a partner. I tend to just, my eyes tend to start to drift towards the ceiling of the cinema if I start to get a bit bored. But it's that I wanted a big science film. I wanted what this film is for the first half. And I love films about aliens arriving. I love all that build-up of tension. And this is brilliantly done. And he's really good with helicopters, which I think is the bit where he becomes Spielberg. But it's... I don't think it's an honest film. And again, we've had a discussion with this off air. It relies on flashbacks that are not flashbacks and become flash forwards as the nature of time is revealed in this film. And I think it has to do too many dishonest script tricks to convince the audience, to trick the audience. That really annoyed me in a film that starts off very sciencey and then becomes, as Jack said, these broad emotional strokes that it hasn't earned.
To give people the context of our off-air conversation, my touch point for this is The Prestige, where I know a lot of people had issues with the twists in the film and felt they were overdone. On my viewing of The Prestige, the first scene says to you, watch closely, and gives you the keys to unlocking the plot. So nothing should come as a surprise.
I don't think that works here because they're not clues.
I'm going to carry on. I think I've seen enough of these films that the structure of these films wasn't a surprise to me. Now, I think I would have had a different experience with the film if I hadn't seen that coming, but I did, and so it becomes a very personal experience for the film. And so consequently, the key takeaways for me from the film were the pieces about communication and the pieces about Amy Adams' effectively lack of choice or choice. You know, it's about the choices we make in life and precognition and you know, would we do things over the same if we knew things? You know, there are big ideas and themes and emotions going on here.
But those themes are so loose that
But do they have to be tied?
I think so, because that's the world the film is set up in the opening 40 minutes. It's Amy Adams at one point, and as one of our reviewers, Bridget Bradshaw, has pointed out, there's a story that Amy Adams tells about how kangaroo, the word kangaroo, comes about, and she convinces the military force, Whittaker's military commander, using the story, and then she says to somebody else, that story is a lie. I felt the second half of the film, and perhaps this is deliberate, but I don't think, if it is, I like it even less. The second half of the film is that kangaroo story. It just reveals lies and mistruths in order to get across the central point. There isn't a twist so much in this as so much pulling the rug out from underneath you, because the visual language in the first quarter of the film is telling you a lie, is convincing you a lie. That annoys me greatly.
I don't think there has to
not
be
enough to make
a great
sentence.
Twist. I disagree with that. For me, it wasn't the twist that, you know, sort of let me down as such. It was that sort of relying on the emotions and how that was portrayed. And I think a key problem with that was, without Amy Adams, who I think really held the film together well, and she was brilliant, without her, who cared about any of the other characters? Jeremy Renner's character wasn't...
What was he actually doing? He's a theoretical physicist. Where does he use that?
He has more of a role in the book, but obviously he is slightly underwritten
in
here.
In this film, he has like a whiteboard, which he says, oh, don't rub off my theoretical physics. And that's about the only example of him doing anything. Other than that, he's like standing next to her, being the white heterosexual counterpart. I wonder what could happen. Oh, we've got a film called Passengers coming out soon as well, haven't we? And it's like, why do they wake up? Because they're a heterosexual couple in space, probably have to get together.
There's a twist in that film.
It's not Jeremy Renner's story, it's Amy Adams' story. I feel
I don't think that's true, because the end is... Sorry, Yossi, the end is reliant on a connection between those two characters. And
it's actually reliant on a disconnection between those two characters.
Well, that's all very well and good, but then still I feel like we do need to be a little bit more invested in Jeremy Renner's character, because he did just come across as a little bit of a decoration in the film, and it was very much the Amy Adams show for me, and that's not necessarily a bad thing because I love Amy Adams, but what what was going on with the rest of it, really. It just sort of let me down in terms of how the characters were written, and also, you know, certain other plot points that just seemed a bit cliche. I think the Chinese general, I can't remember his name, he was a bit caricature-y.
He's a caricature, and then he's not, and then suddenly he's three-dimensional at the very end when language is played its role. I think that I can see those.
And I had a soft spot for him because he was also the Chinese general in 24 with Kiefer Sutherland, and he was the ultimate bad guy in that. So I had a soft spot for him, which may have biased my view towards the film. I will hold my hand up. Certain character actors come in and instantly elevate me to liking a film slightly more. But I don't think that got me to like the film as much as I did. And I'm interested in some of these points about the structure of the film. Having done some sort of reading after the film, particularly about linguistic relativity and the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, a theory which in linguistics is apparently now discredited, but it's very much about the structure of language and the structure of which feeds into the film. And I think it's those layers for me, and unpicking those, and I think there's a deep irony in the fact that I can't quite find the language to explain why I loved the film so much when it's a film about language and communication, particularly when I'm trying to convince listeners on the radio why I loved it so much. But it the whole film is a framework for deep emotional feelings and thoughts. And I think maybe I'm just a big softie. Maybe I just open myself up to those thoughts and maybe overlooked flaws in the dialogue or the story, because I didn't feel those while I was watching it in anywhere near the same way that any of the three of you did.
I didn't.
But ultimately, I had a huge emotional experience with the film. You know, I was gripped by it at points and I was deeply affected by it.
I was expecting to feel like it was a film about language and communication or sci-fi or something like that. And by the end, I thought, I've been like tricked into some kind of family affairs drama here, and it's actually about like planning your family and difficult choices that parents have to make when they know certain issues. And I was like, oh, I've been sold a bit of a con here with this film.
Whereas I hate sci-fi normally, so for me, the elements I did like that it had this theme about communication, and I have been a bit of a negative ninny, and I'm trying also to be positive, and I will say that the communication themes, the idea of language and how we communicate with these aliens, I did actually really like how that was explored, and I thought that was to the film's credit. So I just want to...
But it's one of your... I want to end on a positive, but this is one of your... a quick positive. One of your favourite films of the year. And it matches the tone that you set over the last few years on the show, Robot and Frank and other things. You've science fiction that contains this kernel of humanity.
Absolutely, and you know, I can see parallels in the likes of Close Encounters with that. You know, I think it's a different view to a Spielberg view, but there's a lot of commonality in terms of the world view. It's slightly less sentimental and sugary, but it still has big emotions. It is my favourite film of the year. I hope that 50% of the audience will feel the same way I did, and hopefully the other 50% will find something they can feel equally passionate about.
All right. Well, Arrival opened last Friday, now screening at all three Cambridge cinemas, and it is a certificate 12A. With the next leader of the free world, a self-confessed lecherous and groping sex predator, there seems no better time for a film like The Innocents, a movie that looks at the horrendous, long-lasting reverberations of sexual assault. Set just after the end of the Second World War and based on a true story, The Innocents stars Lou Delage as Mathilde Boyer, a Red Cross doctor working in the ruins of Poland. Reluctantly, she answers a call from a local Benedictine convent, where a young nun is about to give birth. The baby is delivered successfully, but after Mathilde visits the convent a second time, it becomes horribly apparent that a violent visit from passing Red Army soldiers has left many of the nuns pregnant. You'll see, starting with you, it's The Innocents is certainly a difficult film to watch at times, but does its director Anne Fontaine, who is a popular director in a French film, does she ever lift the story out of a sort of difficult to watch but polished biopic territory?
I think she does well with it. It is difficult to watch. However, I did not think it was too heavy-handed. I think it was quite a nuanced, impressive exploration of the sort of emotional themes behind what has happened to these nuns in Poland. And what I liked about it was that it was quite slow going, and it was something that I was truly invested with in terms of its characters and its storyline. And I think she did quite well in dealing with such a difficult story, with such a difficult subject matter, and portraying it on the screen. I don't think it's as good as something, for example, like Ida. I think there are certain things that perhaps it could have developed further. The main French character, Mathilde, for example, although I liked her character in general, she was portrayed a bit saintly at times, and sometimes it didn't quite wash with me. But in general, I thought the film was very well done, and it looked beautiful as well. There were some scenes on the camera that just really struck me and were just... And it was a good film. I really enjoyed... Well, you can't really enjoy a film like that, but I liked it. I thought it was well done.
Jack?
I really enjoyed it as well, I have to say, but my question as I was leaving the auditorium was, how many supermodels can you fit into a nunnery? Because so many of those nuns were astoundingly beautiful, and also the lead actress, her face was kind of like you'd see it on Vogue or something like that. And I was wondering, are we affected here by this representation of femininity in its most like heightened sense of beauty? They all, without I'd say, other than like the mother superior, the abbess?
Yeah, the sister superior. Yes.
Everyone else just seemed like they'd stepped off the catwalk and donned like a nun outfit, and then got pregnant.
There's an interesting irony in that, and that apparently the actress who plays the Mother Superior was nearly not cast because she was deemed too sexy and had to do a reading for Anne Fontaine to convince her that she could actually play the Mother Superior.
It's Agathe Bousset, who's also
the drinking aunt in Ida, yes.
Yes,
I mean, to me that's interesting because of the depictions of people like the Virgin Mary in religion, you know, because we have this ideal of beauty, and it's that corrupted ideal that's portrayed in the film, because, you know, the soldiers have come in and you know, maybe they were more keen to do that because of the perception of the nuns that they had. So there's some interesting themes going on for me there. I don't know if the film takes too much time to explore them, but you know, it is interesting that we almost, you know, look at the nuns and judge them. But it does to me feel deliberate that the nuns are portrayed physically in which the way that they are.
We probably haven't got quite enough time, but as usual. But it's we could have started the show with any of the four films. They're all fascinating. But is it a case, I think, that a film should be told from in this case, it's told from the character's point of view. It never drifts from what they would have known at the time. It's not a modern sensibility like something like The Imitation Game, which is very much a modern take on an historical event. And that annoyed me about that case. But here, I kept wanting the director and the camera to pull back, to put this in context. Not just simply because recent events in America, which has legitimised not this behaviour, but behaviour approaching this, normalised it. But because the film never, and this is my problem with nuns in general, but the film never dealt with the fact, it looked like it was going to deal with it, but it never dealt with the fact they were already in a patriarchal, abusive relationship in the religion they were in. They were already slightly put in this position. Not that they wouldn't have been persecuted by the Red Army soldiers if they'd just been civilians, but they did not have the ability to deal with it because of this male-dominated relationship they were already in, and the film never dealt with that, and that annoyed me very much.
There's an interesting thing that got me thinking at the beginning of the film as well, because they mention that there should be a male priest who's sort of, you know,
yes,
within the convent, and that role is currently vacant.
Well, I think he was killed. I think he was killed in the Red Army attack.
Yes, but they've not filled that role, so they go through the course of the film without that direct patriarchal figure there, just, of course, the patriarchal figure of their god, who is imposing on them such will that they almost devoid of free choice about certain events which they would like to have free choice in.
But I think, you'll see, I felt personally that the film, that was an avenue the film should have explored. It's not what the film should have been about, but it should have at least been aware of it. It didn't seem... There's a moment where the young doctor, with a Red Cross doctor, who's a communist, French communist, where she's sort of lulled into a sexual intercourse with the male doctor, and it, in the end, it's a consensual relationship, but there is a moment where you suspect it may not be. And again, the film seemed to be looking at a bigger picture here of how sexual assault is endemic across men of all nationalities, and it partly stems from the role of the church. But again, the film sort of backs off that, I felt.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't go into it very much, and it doesn't explore it. In terms of the nuns and the fact that there is this male priest that they talk about, which Mark mentioned, perhaps the director decided not to focus too much on that because she did want it to be about these women. She wanted it to be a story of these women and their relationship with God, which has severely come into question because of the events that have unfolded. And I was all right with that. I thought that was the question of their faith was a good one. Actually, I wanted that to be explored more throughout the film because I thought that was a very interesting aspect to it. And in fact, I don't feel like that theme was developed.
No, they look at it, and one character suggests of my faith being tested, and you get an idea from the Sister Superior that her faith in a different way is being tested. But I felt the film kept, especially with the finale the film gives us, and the fact that the film ignores that in the real life situation, many of the nuns were killed in the same attack. The film always seems to be backing away from any form of long resonance, and any it's a difficult film to watch, but it still feels not cozy, but it's not Beyond the Hills or something. It's not really difficult to watch.
And I think with the ending as well, the way it's quite sucrose, isn't it? It's like quite nicely tied up, and it's like a happy ending. And I think that again takes away perhaps from the resonance of key themes and keys.
You could also read it as women becoming whole when they're given children, which is rather insulting. it's a very lazy ending, I felt.
Well, I think maybe it doesn't focus enough on the fate of some of the babies, which you're sort of left to ponder silently rather than it being portrayed on screen.
And then that's a... Again, I can't ramble on, but it's the idea, because it's a fairly this is based on a very basic, austere diary. And again, so like Arrival, the director has had to populate it with characters and in terms, and this is not a dig at Arrival, but in terms of cliches in order to keep it going. So the Sister Superior almost becomes the villain. It's a little bit more rounded than that, but not much. And all of these things, I just felt to me like it kept pulling back this huge story that has so many modern repercussions and resonances, especially, but that was obviously Anne Fontaine wasn't going to know the direction that America would take, but it's there in everything. It keeps pulling it back into being art house fare, into being reasonably safe, in having no resonance, having no complication to it. It's a difficult watch, but that's difficult from being hard-hitting.
And I think it's what keeps it from being a genuinely great film rather than just a good one, which it is. A different last 10 minutes would have made this film an absolute powerhouse, and it just missed the mark at the end, sadly.
Okay, all right. Well, The Innocence opened... Thank you, everybody. The Innocence opened last Friday and is... which was November the 11th, apparently, and is still showing at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
The Cambridge Film Festival may be over with, but that doesn't mean there aren't other chances to see the best in world cinema. Indeed, the first week of December brings five new Russian movies to Cambridge, courtesy of the Cambridge Russian Speaking Society, taking place from the 29th of November to the 4th of December in St. John's College and Trinity and Trinity Hall, and there's a third venue to mention. This is the very first Cambridge Russian Film Festival. Films showing are recent Russian releases, their subject matters ranging from hushed romance to historical conflict and big city lives. To find out more about the Russian Film Week, in a moment we'll be speaking to Yelena Karl, member of the Cambridge Russian Speaking Society and one of the event's coordinators. But first, let's hear a trailer for one of the films, Moscow Never Sleeps, which is screening on Sunday the 4th.
Еще раз с Днем города вас, дорогие москвичи и гости нашей прекрасной столицы. Погода у нас сейчас роскошная.
День города, праздник. Сходите, повеселитесь куда-нибудь.
С этой конченой она даже не разговаривает.
Передают, что если не согласимся, в общем, нам крышка тогда.
Мы не прогнемся.
Кать, я знаю, ты там, ты меня слышишь. Ты не можешь делать вид, что меня не было.
Подождешь меня вот в этом кафе? А ты куда? Я с другом встречусь и вернусь.
Ну вы же знаменитость, а? Давайте по одной.
Давай, пошел, аргументируй.
Смотри, кого мы тебе привели.
Они меня похитили.
Ты дебил!
Это нельзя сделать без моего разрешения.
Что-то не нравится? Можешь ехать в Лондон.
Как сбежать из тюрьмы, которую любишь?
Дать взятку надзирателю.
And I'm joined in the studio by Elena Carr. Hello, thank you for coming in.
Hello, Toby. Thank you for inviting me on the programme. I love the name, by the way.
Oh, it's got us into more trouble than it's worth. To begin, would you be able to explain, the best place to start before we get into the film festival, would you be able to explain a little bit about the Cambridge Russian-speaking society?
Yes. I want to say that CAMRUS, as we call it, Cambridge Russian Speaking Society is a non-profit community organization run by volunteers. We have 1,500 subscribers, and 50% of those are native Russian speakers.
Is there a bit? Is there a sizable Russian speaking population in Cambridge?
It is. It's not just Cambridge. It's also surrounding. And I have to say, it's quite old. It was founded in 1999. With the main goals of to help people to learn about Russian culture, history, traditions, language, and also to promote understanding between people of different cultures and nationalities in Cambridge and around it.
So, as part of this, you have this first film festival,
yes,
which is very welcome because
yes,
even in the Cambridge the main film festival, we don't get very much Russian cinema, and we don't get hardly any contemporary mainstream Russian cinema. What was where was the genesis of this project? I know one of the films, Two Women, was something you'd
yes,
seen.
Yes, it just happens that I saw this film, Two Women, in September when it was showing mainly in London, almost by chance. And then I loved it so much that I really, really wanted my friends to see it as well. And I thought the easiest way is probably to bring film to Cambridge rather than try to organize everybody and try to see it in small places somewhere outside London. So I wrote to a few people who I thought would help me, but I didn't get any reply. And then my friend, Ksenia Afonina, who is the president of our society, heard about this Russian Film Week in London being planned, decided to contact the organizer, his name is Philippe Percon, and luckily he agreed to lend us some movies. So that's how it all started.
So you have Two Women, which has Ralph Fiennes in it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Speaking in Russian. So
yes,
he learnt the language for the role.
Yes, we heard that he spent 2 months living in Russia learning the language for the part. And then in Russia, this film was shown with double voice. And he insisted on learning the language and actually re-recording over his double.
So you have this one historical, it's based on a novel or a play?
Well, Two Women are based on a play called A Month in the Country by the classic Russian writer Ivan Turgenev. And it's actually a Russian love story. Besides loving this Russian love story, I really was impressed by brilliant performances of all the actors and beautiful scenes and authentic costumes. I think it's very interesting for...
So that is on the 2nd of December, which is the second day of the film festival proper. What are you opening the festival with on the 1st of December?
I have to say about Two Women one more thing, that the film director is coming, Vera Glagolева is coming. She will present the film and also do a Q&A. So we're opening the festival on the 1st of December with two films, a short called Shredder. And that's a short film based on real life events when the audience of a radio show was asked to vote for the murder of a piece of art live on air. It's good.
So you open with this short.
Yeah. And then it's a full meter called Heritage of Love. In Russia, it was shown under the name Hero, Герой. And that's a romantic story on the eve of the First World War. A young Duchess Vera and the Russian Imperial Army officer Andrei meet under rather strange circumstances and they fall in love. And then this story continues 100 years later. And I have to say that we're expecting director Yuri Vasilyev to come for Q&A as well.
The visiting filmmakers is really exciting.
This is the best part, I think.
I know, that's a, it's And then on the 3rd of December, you've got Contribution, if I've written
it
down correctly.
Yes, Contribution has a wonderful ensemble of first-class actors. It's set in Russia during the Civil War in 1918. So the story is about this group that, in order to survive, a detective who is sentenced to death for his ties to the Red Army must find a stolen diamond that was donated to the White Army cause. So that's the premise.
And on the last day, which we've just played the trailer,
mm-hmm. for yes, Moscow Never Sleeps. Yes, on the last day, on the 4th of December, we're showing Moscow Never Sleeps. It's a look at contemporary life in Moscow through the eyes of an Irish film director, Johnny O'Reilly. I have to say, he lived in Moscow for 12 years. So
yeah,
he
considers that his home now. He's not sort of visiting. So
he knows what he's talking about. He's also coming. Well, we're lucky. We actually convinced him to postpone his return to Ireland, and he's coming to present a film and do Q&A as well.
This is on the way to Ireland, so
sort of. Yeah, London, Cambridge, Ireland. Yeah.
He said something very interesting in an interview about the film. Is of course that we don't know very much. We don't see Moscow properly in cinema. It's always this faceless other in terms of cities. It's always where in Hollywood thrillers and in British movies. So this is actually
a real one.
Exactly. This is a chance to burrow into the different lives that are.
I want to make one point about how we chose these films. First of all, we looked at the program of the Russian Film Week and picked up the films that we thought that would be interesting to an English audience. And then we try to choose some films that are art house and some mainstream. And also we did this selection that stretches over the period of time, starting with the 19th century, with the two women, and then all the way to the modern days with Shredder and Moscow Never Sleeps and the Revolution, Civil War and World War One in between. So it kind of shows different time periods in Russian life. And I find quite interesting that there is an English actor in one of them and an Irish director who made another one. So quite excited about this.
You also, again, on the historical direction, I know it's not part of the film festival, it's not part of the films you've got from London Film Week, but you have on the 29th of November an additional sixth film.
Mm-hmm. We are planning one more screening. As you mentioned, it's not a part of the London Russian Film Week. It's called World War One, and we invited its producer, Igor Ugolnikov, it's quite known in Russia, and playwright Evgeny Isakovich to Cambridge to present it and to do a Q&A. So they'll be coming on the 29th. So this collection of short international films is a result of cooperation between filmmakers from 8 different countries. It's Serbia, Germany, Turkey, England, Canada, Russia, the USA, and France. And at the time of World War One, some of these countries were allies and some of them were enemies. But now we see how all their authors share their perception of the historical events, of this historical event, the World War One, and all of them agree that the war is ugly and the war doesn't spare anybody. I have to say the unique feature of this almanac is the joint storyline. It's the all the novels, all the short stories connected by the common storyline about a war veteran who is on his 100th anniversary tells his granddaughter about the war.
So that's on the 29th of November and then it's on the 1st of December. Mm-hmm. Now it's very much worth pointing out, it's vital to point out that these are screenings for everybody. As you said, you pick films for UK audiences, you've picked a wide range of historic to get a breadth of history, and these are films that will have English subtitles and translators for visiting filmmakers. And
yes, I want to make it absolutely clear for your listeners that the festival is not just for Russian speakers. All films are shown in English subtitles, and there would be interpreters at each Q&A. And we would love to have as many British moviegoers as possible at all these movies. I have to say the program is great. You will see, you can see 6 films. You can meet 4 creative teams. We do have We're selling tickets in advance. If you go to our website, which is www.kamruz.com, and just look at events and click on the event, there are links to buy tickets in advance. It's £6 full ticket, four concessions. And then if you do it on the door, it's £1 more. So I would advise you to do it in advance to make sure you have seats. These are small lecture halls in colleges. So
what are the actual locations? I know you're in St. Mm-hmm. John's Divinity College, aren't
you? It's on the 29th of November, we have Trinity Hall, their main lecture theatre. On the 1st and the 2nd of December, we're showing it in the old Divinity School of St. John's College. And then on the 3rd and the 4th of December, it would be Winstanley Lecture Hall in Trinity College. So it's all very central, central location.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Very, very good luck. I think this is very exciting.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's always wonderful to see
thank
cinema.
Thank you, Toby. I hope that this talk will create more bums on the seats at our festival.
It's our aim. That's the only reason we have that title.
Perfect. Let's see. Bums on seats in Russian?
I don't know if I can use that language.
Well, as long as it roughly means... Yeah, go ahead.
Popy na stuliach.
Popy na stuliach.
Oh, that's brilliant. Okay. Look how easily enamoured we are with anything vaguely exotic. Okay, all right. Well, let's move on, I think.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bums on Seats with me, Toby Miller, and reviewers Josie Osman, Mark Livicic and Jack Toy. Still to come on the show in a very rushed 15 minutes or so, we've got Life After, but also Before Harry Potter, before we're scratching the door to get back in again.
Excuse me, do you know whose cat this is?
Bob came to you for a reason.
Bob?
That's what he wants you to call him.
In the past, I've screwed up every opportunity I've been given.
Oh. I don't want to go that way.
You're doing great. James, you can't take on too much too far.
I'm ready. I've got Bob. Standing by your side. He'll look after me.
You're keeping him, aren't you?
Give it a try, help Bob and I. Bob, show me what life could be like on the other side.
You want to come again tomorrow? Satellite mama.
Everyone gets a second chance. Luckily for me, I had a very important companion to help with my second chance. Don't look at me like that. High five.
Directed by Roger Spottiswoode, A Street Cat Named Bob stars Luke Treadaway as real-life James Bowen, a down-on-his-luck musician living on the London streets. A fresh start is reliant on Bowen succeeding as a Covent Garden busker and finally kicking his destructive heroin habit, two tasks that seem sadly beyond him. Then, one evening, he discovers a ginger tomcat foraging in his kitchen, a chance encounter that will lead to a most surprising friendship. Mark, I sort of skipped over the fact, as I'm ad-libbing now, that this is based on an autobiography on the best-selling A Street Cat Named Bob, which I'd never heard of, but it's a big deal, lots and lots of different books. But is making a film of this uplifting true story an adaptation too far, do you think?
I think some very odd things in terms of the adaptation. I may be telling that Roger Spottiswoode hasn't made a big name film for about 16 years. Some of the London travelogue pieces feel like an episode of Friends that ended up on the cutting room floor.
Guest stars don't help popping up.
There's some very stilted scenes where they say, oh, we should make a book about this. It looks interesting. Which did grate a little bit, but I think it's actually greater than some of its parts in that sense. I think there's a core of human emotion, and it's got an adorable cat that sits on shoulders, which I'm an absolute sucker for. And it's the real cat.
I think it's one of many cats. I think there's several cats playing the main cat.
Apparently most of the cats in the film were Bob.
I'd need to see pictorial evidence of this. I'll wait for the making of before I perform.
Given that apparently ginger cats all look so alike, how do we know that it's not other cats filling in for Bob in real life? You know,
is horrible. This is terrible. He's living a lie.
Yes, this dystopian cat.
His book deals are a house of cards that we've removed the bottom card.
He's probably enslaved other ginger cats to do his bidding.
It seems a weird leap to make, but I found this film. I found this film profoundly depressing. It's fairly shoddy filmmaking, but it's not terrible. I think it's because it's an easy film to sort of dismiss. Oh, it's a film about this best-selling story, about this the big issue seller, this musician who had a cat. But there's some really points that it almost makes really well about the need of the use that pets have in mental health and the difficulty in the necessity of the social service. Again, timely. This isn't I, Daniel Blake, but it is almost a sort of school's version of that.
It makes a good companion piece in that sense. And I think I need to stress that I really liked this film, despite the fact it's shoddily made. It really did warm my heart. But also the portrayal around the methadone addiction, the drug scenes, the family conflicts, there's an honesty to them, even if sometimes they descend into sitcom cliche, particularly a scene where Bob is let loose in a family's Christmas home, which is a bit despairing. But actually, the relationship between Luke Treadaway's character and Bob, absolutely warms. It's a shame it wasn't just a two-hander, really.
Because the core of that relationship is what the book's about. I think that's something vital it could have been saying, and I don't think it's saying it quite loudly enough. It's a 12A. I don't quite know what audience. Obviously, heroin addiction is not a staple of children's entertainment, but cute cats are. So I don't know what audience this is aiming for and what it's hoping to achieve. It really is a bundle of things that don't quite work.
I think it's aiming to reach the 76 million people who bought the original book.
Really? Is it that many?
It is that many. It was, it's been a big hit. It was in the top 10 bestseller list in America as well. It's one for fans of the book, really. I think it contains the answer to world peace and saving people, because what it doesn't really touch on is the issue that everyone likes Luke Treadaway's character that much more, James Bowen, when he has Bob.
Exactly.
My plan is get all the cats from Wood Green and the other animal shelters, give them to all the homeless people, they'll all make more money, get off the streets, job done.
There's a scene in this, which is allowed to be a final point, so of course I'm saying it, but it's where Luke Treadaway, James Bowen's character, says when he's finally being weaned off methadone as his replacement for heroin, is in that I was spoken to a man who wouldn't normally, a man in a suit, a city person, called me sir because he wanted a picture with a cat, and I want that respectability. I want to be in that world. That struck me as a really dud note, because you were only being called sir because you had a gimmick, and the fact that your poverty, the terrible situation that you are in, which is of no fault of his own, not that that would overly matter in a fair society, a kind society, is only being noticed because you have a cat video on your shoulder. And the film is aware of this despairing kernel of awfulness, that you need a gimmick for it to be rescued.
Particularly with another big issue seller that feels he's losing out because he hasn't got a gimmick.
Yeah.
But the film just shies away from it, which is a shame, because there would be more material there, but I think it maybe just tries to stay faithful to the book.
Okay. All right. Anyway, A Street Cat Named Bob opened last week and is still screening numerous screenings at the Light Cinema. It is a certificate 12A. Set decades before the Harry Potter saga and scripted by J.K. Rowling herself, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is a strange follow-up to the Harry Potter films. It introduces a new hero in Newt Scamander, played by Eddie Redmayne. Scamander is a globe-trotting collector of fantastical creatures who wraps up his travels in 1926 New York with a supernatural suitcase which is overflowing with a magical menagerie. But after a few of the beasts escape into the suburbs of the city, Newt is forced into an uncomfortable partnership with poor Bettina Goldstein, a witch played by Katherine Waterson.
You've known for 24 hours that an unregistered wizard set magical beasts loose in New York?
Yes.
Where is this man?
So, you're the guy with the case full of monsters, huh?
Use travels first.
Mr. Scamander, do you know anything about the wizarding community in America? We don't let things loose.
Hey, Mr. English guy, I think your egg is hatching.
You wiped his memory, right? The no magic.
The what?
No magic. The non-wizard.
Sorry, we call them muggles.
This is related to Grindelwald's attacks in Europe. This could mean war.
We got a plan, right, guys?
They need our help.
We
Was that everything that came out of the case?
Jack, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. The title suggests sort of a more of an adventurous romp than how dark and moody the Harry Potter films got by the end. Is that the case, or is J.K. Rowling's script, does it have other things on its mind?
It suggests it, but it's really satisfying at how perilous and kind of sad and tragic certain parts of this film are, and I think it really works well, and it's perhaps taking it out of that high school or wizarding school scenario and putting it onto the Prohibition-era streets of New York that work well. But I felt in a very safe pair of hands with Rowling's screenplay, and I was very worried about going in to see it. I saw it at the midnight screening, so I was tired already, and I thought, this is a new franchise, there's every reason why this should fail. And I was completely enthralled by it all the way through, and as you may have picked up on previous reviews on the show, I'm not the biggest fan of Eddie Redmayne at all, and yet this is by far my favourite portrayal of him on screen. And I was thinking he's somewhere between Harry Potter, Doctor Who and Willy Wonka in this, and he has this box that all of these creatures live in. When he steps inside, it's like stepping into the TARDIS, or it's like stepping into the chocolate factory the first time, and the CGI has somehow upscaled about 200% compared to the trailer. And we were watching the trailer and thinking, God, this looks a bit ropey, like, how have they gone back with the CGI? The film looks fantastic. I'm not going to use that word any more times. The film looks very, very impressive. The narrative has lots of twists and turns and kind of saves a lot of them for the final act. Maybe if some other people want to talk about that, they can do. There's a big plot spoiler that had kind of come out before the film, which I knew about, but it was still really satisfying when it happened in the film.
Let's just skip on, because we only have 6 or so minutes left. You'll see, is this a step too far? As it's nice to have J.K. Rowling writing this, but is it The Hobbits compared to The Lord of the Rings? Is it or is it another? Why are we going back to this particular well? Or is there a good enough thematic reason, a good enough plot to be able to draw back into this world?
There is potential. I will say, if you are going to go to this film expecting something like Harry Potter, don't, because it is not Harry Potter. It is different. I think it is wondrous. It is, you know, the creatures are great. I particularly love the little Niffler, the one that steals all the jewellery. He's very cute, and I love the way the creatures were done, and it is a good adventure film. In terms of plot, my issue with it was I thought there were a few too many plot strands that weren't developed enough throughout the film, and because it's quite slow to get the action started. I think for the first half an hour, 40 minutes, there's not much that really happens, and then suddenly stuff happens.
Do they stick, because it's really two plots, the Fantastic Beasts plot, the film that many people would have been expecting, this jolly romp with funny animals, is almost, not quite, but almost completely separate to the plot involving the American Ministry for Magic and Colin Farrell's aura, the head wizard or whatever, which is where all the thematics and the darkness lie. I don't like using the word darkness, but this is a fairly grim film in some areas. Do those two plots work together? Do they gel?
I think this is where the potential factor lies in, because I don't think they worked quite as well together in this. However, I did see that in future films in the series, perhaps they will, you know...
Oh, it's such a relief that we work like that.
Because, no, I just mean that I could see that they were trying to give hints for what's going to happen in the next films. I still don't know how they're going to make 5 films out of it. I do feel like that's quite a stretch, but there is potential. I kind of wish that the two plots that you mentioned came together a bit better in this film, because I feel like, I don't know, perhaps that's with it being an intro film, they weren't quite as seamless as they could have been.
Mark, I enjoy the thematics of this. I enjoyed, that's a pompous thing to say, I enjoyed the character of Credence and the self-loathing and the grooming that was going on in that character. I thought all of that was surprisingly involving, and I'm not a big Harry Potter fan. Did that all work? Because in the end, I think that's what this film is about, rather than the Fantastic Beasts or a sideshow.
Yeah, and it feels like there's more of an element of darkness in the real world than there is in the original Harry Potter films. I actually weirdly, retrospectively, made those films all feel really claustrophobic to me. And we're stuck in this tiny little location. We never really see the context of magic in the wider world to a great extent in those films. And actually, you know, this feels like a realised world in which we're seeing that now.
But I'm going to quickly come back on that point. Does it mean that now that, one, you've got all your characters that with one bound can be free, And also, there's no rules to this world. There's a lot of destruction in New York in the usual CGI heavy finale, which they repair. If that's possible, where's the drama? Where's the threat? Suddenly, when they were school children that couldn't get the spells right, there was drama in that. This is wizards who can do everything, and everybody can do everything. It's like watching superheroes again. Surely, maybe.
That is what the magicians are portrayed, though, as isn't it? The thing that actually I kept falling back to in terms of comparison was the Star Wars prequels, where it felt like that should have been the world in which we see how powerful the Jedi are and the way in which they use their Jedi powers. And actually, this is a world in which we see magic at its full potential, which we didn't always see in the Harry Potter films. We saw just the rough edges of it. So I actually liked a lot of that. The other touch point I felt was the elements of Tim Burton. It's not anywhere near as oddball as Tim Burton, but some of that darkness that runs through some of his earlier films, a particular thing, particularly in the non-beast subplot, I found really satisfying.
There's one scene in the Ministry, the New York Ministry of Magic, I can't remember its official title, where two characters are sentenced to death, which I thought was striking. The fact that it even existed in this world, and Catherine Waterston, the witch in the character, she was horrified, but she didn't question it. And she didn't say, well, wait a minute, this isn't our universe. This was obviously their universe. I thought that was quite amazing to be in the middle of this otherwise fairly cuddly film. Yossi, you wanted to come in on a point some time ago. Maybe we've moved on.
I can't remember what that point was. I apologise. But yes, that's the thing with the exploration factor, though. There's a lot. This is the real world now. This isn't Hogwarts. So there's a lot to look into. There's a lot of new stuff, which is exciting.
Is it as interesting as that world, though? So I'm speeding things up. I don't mean to interrupt you. But because the Harry Potter films looked at fascism within their own community. This is looking at human fascism in Samantha Morton's character as this sort of religious leader who believes witches are among them. We know that. That's fairly routine. And we're back to X-Men. This could be an X-Men film with a battle between mutants and non-mutants. Again, this is for all the... I can't see this going anywhere that we haven't been several times before with other... We're the Registration Act in the last Avengers film. We keep going around in these circles, surely, these narrative circles.
And the real world doesn't seem to be learning the lessons from these films, does it?
No, it took all those Nazis from history sort of programmes as actual lessons.
Maybe we need to keep rubbing it down people's throats.
Sorry.
But to some extent, I'll just say this really quickly, it's for the fans. And the fans care about what's happening with these wizards in the real world and how we can explore this further. And I think if you're a fan of the Harry Potter world, and to some extent even if you're not, that there's a lot of stuff that is interesting enough in this film and hopefully in the rest of the series that will keep you going.
Jack, I want to come to you with a specific point you can end on. It was fun to watch the Harry Potter cast grow up and grow older and grow into their roles. Is that going to be the same case with Catherine Waterston, with Eddie Redmayne, with Ezra Miller, with Alison Sudol?
I wish Ezra Miller would be in it more because he's one of my favourite actors and he's hardly used and he was fantastic in this. I'm not sure if we will see them all grow old. We have differing views on where the narrative's going to go. I just wanted to say quickly there's a point in the film which I just thought looked absolutely gorgeous. I don't know if it is the DOP, Philippe Rousselot's intention, or if it was someone else, but there's a shot where the camera pans up a staircase as a whole flat has been kind of blown up, and very quickly Newt Scamander is trying to build it all back up again. The camera kind of tracks left to right, and as it does with Tina walking up the stairs, he's there on his bed, and all of a sudden he makes it all look beautiful, and I've run out of time, but it's really nice.
Okay, all right, well, thank you. Fantasy Beasts is open now. And that's the end of the show. Podcast repeat. Goodbye.
On FM, online, and DAB digital radio. This is Cambridge.